Okay, does anyone have any questions about the course or anything? Before the midterm, someone asked me about imperialism. So today I'm going to be talking about imperialism. Extremely important phenomenon in the whole story of great power politics in the period before the First World War. All right? When you look at that story as a whole, you're struck by the difference between international politics before 1890 and after 1890. You're struck by the difference between German policy before 1890 and after 1890. Bismarck was still in power in the period following the creation of the German Empire in 1871. Germany was a status quo state. Germany was a satiated state. Germany was not interested in changes in the status quo in Europe. Germany wanted to stabilize the status quo in Europe under Bismarck. Bismarck falls in 1890 and you have a rather different Germany coming into being. No longer a status quo power. Country wants dramatic changes in the status quo. No longer interested in just stabilizing things. This is a restless country, you know, deeply dissatisfied with the way things are. And that change in German policy is connected with, it's not the only cause of, but it's certainly connected with, the change in the international system that you find taking place at about that time. System before 1890, it was not rock solid, it was not deeply stable, it was not as though war was inconceivable among the major powers. But it didn't seem like there was any momentum, any thrust toward war. It didn't seem like events had a certain direction to them, that the world was moving toward war. We can't say that after 1890. And especially in the period after the turn of the century, the decade before the First World War, you did have this increasing sense that a conflagration, a Europe-wide conflagration, was just a question of time. Things seemed to be moving in a certain direction. Right? So 1890 is very, very important. I said that, you know, that's why this is the kind of midway point in the course. That's why you had the midterm covering the period up to 1890. The rest of the course is going to be dealing with the general issue of the origins of the First World War. No?
I'm sure you're going to get to that in subsequent classes, but why was there this inevitable left scare European life?
Well, it's a difficult issue to kind of sort out. And what we want to do in the class is get at the logic underlying the course of events. You know, why was it that things were moving in that direction? Right? So it's a complex thing, and I can't, you know, pretend to answer it in just a few sentences. But the point of the lecture today is that a large part of that explanation, a large part of the reason for this change, for the fact that German policy had a totally different character after 1890, or international politics had a very different character after 1890, has to do with this whole phenomenon of imperialism. The fact that imperialism, you know, arrived on the scene and very significant effect on the sorts of policies that were pursued, not just by Germany, but by the European states, the great European powers more generally. In fact, even by the United States, because this is the beginning of America's imperial role at this time. The war against Spain and the acquisition of a colonial empire, the Philippines, 1898. This is a worldwide phenomenon. Why was it so important? Was it because the whole process of carving up the world, imperial expansion, forced these European states into conflict with each other? Well, it's an extraordinary fact that the entire continent of Africa was divided up without a war between the European states. An entire continent. And these European powers, in the process of imperial expansion, were often quite able to cooperate with each other. And the most extraordinary example of that is the way they cooperated, and the Americans played a role in this too, cooperated in putting down the Boxer Revolt in China, nationalistic revolt, anti-foreign revolt in China in 1900. Big international expedition. Okay. As far as Germany was concerned, it wasn't as though Germany made any great imperial gains. You know, Germany picked up some colonies in 1884 just as a byproduct of a maneuver that Bismarck had engaged in order to, you know, make things difficult for Gladstone. Right? But Germany didn't really get anything more after that. Right? It wasn't as though, you know, this was a serious, successful policy and the process of building a colonial empire. Germany, you know, alienated all these other powers. And in fact, none of the powers got very much after 1890. You know, the partition of Africa was pretty much finished by that point. Right? There are only two independent states left in Africa, kind of, by the time this whole story ran its course. You know, Liberia, which is basically an American protectorate, and Ethiopia, which the Italians tried to conquer, and actually were defeated. This is one of the very few cases in which a European power was defeated by an indigenous people in Africa. The Italians were defeated at a Dawa in 1897. If you're interested. Well, the sense at the time was that the whole imperial story was by no means over with the partition of Africa. And in fact, people thought that that was just the opening gun. People thought that the European powers were going to move next and divide up the whole part of the world that lay between Europe and sub-Saharan Africa. Lord Salisbury called the dying countries. He gave the speech in which he distinguished between the living countries, the European powers and their descendants, and the dying countries. The dying countries were countries that had a certain existence in the state system. They were states, but they were not sovereign the same way that European states were in the eyes of the Europeans, right? And this was this whole band of countries called, in those days, Oriental despotisms that ran from Morocco in the west through Egypt, the Ottoman Empire, Persia, all the way to China in the east. And these countries were just ripe for being carved up into European colonies, the assumption was. Much more important than sub-Saharan Africa. In other words, imperialism wasn't important because of what had already happened. It was important because of what people thought would happen and should happen in the years to come. Okay? And these imperial aspirations on the part of these different European powers, and above all on the part of Germany, were important, not so much because of what was actually going on overseas, but they were important because of the impact they had on relations among the European powers. And in particular, on relations between Germany and England. Because Germany developed the aspiration of displacing Britain as the world's premier imperial power. And to that end, till the end of the century, the Germans decided to build a fleet, to become a major naval power. Some of the Germans had never been before. As an instrument for becoming a great colonial power, great imperial power. Why is this important? Because this is the third great strand in the story. I think I mentioned a couple of times this idea that you get in Sontag. You want to understand the First World War, you have to see it as the coming together of these three great conflicts. The conflict between Germany and France over Alsace-Lorraine, the conflict between Austria and Russia over the Balkans, and the conflict between Britain and Germany over imperial, colonial and naval issues. But it's not just German policy that has to be taken into account, because Germany was not the only country with imperial aspirations. Right? Germany was in fact the least successful of the major European countries in our pursuit of an imperial policy. You have Britain, dominating the entire world. You don't have most important parts of Africa, South Asia, British colonies, plus this huge informal empire in southern China, the whole Yangtze Basin, and South America, especially Brazil and Argentina, part of Britain's informal empire. Right? This has to do, above all, with the fact that Britain was the world's first industrial power. And because of her insular position, she was by far the world's foremost naval power, able to translate her industrial strength into the construction of a navy, which is, congenial for a rich country because it's a capital-intensive form of military power. Okay? So if you have Britain, you have France interested in acquiring an overseas empire, and a greater France on both sides of the Mediterranean. Russia, continuing to expand toward the south in Central Asia, in imperial aspirations in Persia, certainly toward the Turkish Straits, in Northeast China, Manchuria was called, in fact toward Korea as well. On it goes. United States, I mentioned before, Italy even. And in the course of pursuing those imperial goals, political tensions were created among the European powers, especially between Germany and the Western powers. Important because of their effect on Russian policy, as we'll see. The worse relations got between Germany and the Western powers, the more favorable Russian position was. Russia, there was a competition for Russian favor. That meant that Russia was more able to pursue a forward policy in the Balkans. We'll see how this is one of the central dynamics that led to the First World War. Okay. So it's very, very important. It's what gives meaning to the story. Events are moving in a certain direction. Why? Because there's this deep dissatisfaction with the status quo and the sense that imperial expansion is vital. It's necessary to survive. Okay. How is imperialism to be understood? If it's so important, how is it to be understood? Is it to be understood in purely political terms? From a realist point of view, the point of view of someone like Kenneth Waltz, does imperialism make sense? Well, if you take this view that countries are concerned first and foremost with their own security, does imperialism really make sense? If your margin of security is so narrow that you have to kind of concentrate on doing what's essential to provide for your own security, and you don't have the excess power that you could use for, you know, more ambitious goals. If you're living in that kind of world, would you have expected, for example, a country like Germany to engage in imperial expansion? Doesn't make sense. See, you'll be diverting scarce resources away from land defense, which is your primary need given your geographical position, right? If you're concerned with security, you're concerned with invasion from France and Russia, right? You're cutting back on land defense in order to build a powerful navy. Plus, you have to pay the political price of alienating the world's premier imperial power, Britain, driving Britain over to the side of your adversaries. Does that make sense? Is that rational for Germany to alienate Britain when she already has to contend with France and Russia? And even if you succeed in acquiring colonies, those colonies are going to be hostage to the naval power of your adversaries unless you become so strong that you could take on the rest of the world and the navies of the rest of the world all at the same time. Do you want that? Does that strengthen your position? Now, from a realist point of view, what you should want to do is do whatever you have to strengthen your position in parapolitical terms, both in terms of your raw military power and also the whole web of political relationships that would determine what would happen in the event of a war. Right? Doesn't make sense. Similarly, standpoint of Britain and France, why alienate Germany? If the Germans want to acquire an empire in Africa, if they want to basically take over the Belgian Congo and the Portuguese colonies and Angola and Mozambique, why not just let them do so? Because you'll be able to maintain a decent relationship with them. Why? Because you want to be friends with them as an end in itself? Well, not as an end in itself so much as to reduce your political dependence on Russia. Right? You want a decent relationship with Germany so that you wouldn't be a slave to Russia. You would want a strong Germany as a counterweight to Russia. We want Germany and Russia to balance each other off so that you would hold the balance. And if you poison your relationship with either of those countries, you're dependent on the other. Just like that's straight power political reasoning. And yet you don't find any of these countries thinking in those terms. Right? So if it doesn't make sense in power political terms, you have to kind of look for an explanation outside the political sphere, outside the realm of realpolitik. The sorts of things that international relations theorists like Kenneth Waltz, like to point to. If it doesn't make sense in realist terms, well, maybe there's another way in which it makes sense. Right? And in fact, there is an important body of literature that interprets imperialism in economic terms. Very strong for most of the 20th century, especially on the left. It's kind of gone into decline in recent decades. But you still find these notions, cropping up. People are always looking for economic explanations for why countries act the way they do overseas. A lot of people in Europe today think that America's war against Saddam Hussein had a lot to do with Iraqi oil, et cetera, et cetera. You hear those arguments, from time to time. And so the question for us today, one of the basic questions that we're going to be concerned with today, is what are we to make of that economic interpretation of imperialism? What do we make of the idea that imperialism is to be understood in economic terms? Hmm? And I gave you this article to read for this week by David Landis. I think it's a really nice article because it shows you how far you can get just by bringing a certain theoretical perspective to bear and then kind of looking at the historical evidence through the lens of that perspective. In this case, it's the perspective of, you know, conventional liberal free market theory, free market economics, right? Because Landis makes this argument. He says, well, but you know, you can't just say, oh, well, imperialism is lucrative, that therefore that explains why these countries engage in imperial expansion. That's not the issue. The issue is whether it's more lucrative to engage in formal imperialism with all its costs. You know, setting up political control is not cheap over these vast stretches of territory. This says, couldn't it have been done, you know, without all that formal apparatus of political control? If you just have free market exchanges, wouldn't that have been, you know, plenty lucrative? And he says, if you want to explain why formal control was imposed, you can't explain that unless you can show that you got more by imposing formal control than you would have if you just had free market relationships, right? And this is his whole argument of non-market constraint, the use of political power, you know, to affect the terms of the economic relationship, right? That you can get more by imposing formal control than you would out of a free market relationship. And then he makes these arguments of, you know, no, the free market sort of relationship was actually preferable to business classes and so on. Right? But it's that whole argument about imperialist exploitation, in other words, implies non-market constraint. Exploitation as opposed to simply engaging in normal free trade. You have to show that countries get more out of it. But they don't. Okay. So it's a nice analysis. But in a sense, it isn't really targeted in a direct way on the kind of core arguments that the proponents of the economic interpretation of imperialism actually made. Right? And what were those arguments? What were the arguments made by that school? And the most important figure in that school is J.A. Hobson, who, I think, 1902, right after the turn of the 20th century, wrote an important book on imperialism, which he developed the economic argument. And his arguments were taken off, changed significantly, but basically built upon by Lenin, the founder of the Soviet state, who wrote a very influential pamphlet, quoting from a little while ago, imperialism, the highest stage of capitalism. What's the Hobson argument? How does it relate to kind of mainstream economic thought in the Western countries? Well, mainstream economic thought emphasized the role of markets. This is, you know, Adam Smith, David Ricardo in England, Jean-Baptiste and Léon Valras in France. Their whole notion is, you know, markets are very powerful, and if you allow them to function without obstruction, they will provide for the full employment of all the resources, you know, labor, capital, raw materials that are at the disposal of the economy. Right? You don't have underutilization of resources if markets function effectively. Right? That's the dominant tradition. We still see it today. Liberal tradition. But there was, from the very outset, a counter-tradition that led us a semi-subterranean existence, semi-respectable, semi-unrespectable, disrespectable position in economic thought in the West. And this is the whole idea of No, markets are not that good at providing for the full utilization of resources. Right? There is a basic problem resulting from the inefficiency of markets. You know, when you have industrialization proceeding by leaps and bounds and output, you know, growing in such a dramatic way, you have this problem of how is all that output gonna find its market? Where, who's going to buy all these goods that are being produced in increasing quantities? And say, you can't trust your internal market, your domestic market, to absorb all this new output. Why? Because who has the wherewithal to buy all this stuff? Right? Not the workers, because the workers are basically paid a subsistence wage. And not the wealthier classes, because they're fewer and fewer in number, because as industrialization runs its course and unbridled competition weeds out the weaker firms, you have a concentration of wealth in the hands of fewer and fewer people. And those very wealthy people are not interested in the products of mass production anyway. You're going to have this big problem of overproduction, or looking at it from the other side, underconsumption. Underconsumption as a demon is going to haunt these economies. Right. They're going to feel a structural need to find outlets for all of their excess production over above what can be absorbed. They're going to have to export a whole lot more than they import. The rest of the world is going to have to soak up this excess production. That's the basic argument of Hobson, building on this underconsumptionist kind of counter tradition. And this counter tradition became actually more respectable in the 20th century, because John Maynard Keynes, the most important economist of the 20th century, when he wrote his most important work, which he laid out his basic views in 1936, you know, identified himself very clearly with the underconsumptionist tradition. Why do you need, you know, massive government intervention in the economy? Because markets can't do it. The rest of the economy by itself cannot absorb all this output. You need an injection of demand from the government, right? So that's, and Keynes, you know, explicitly identified himself with the tradition represented by Hobson. Okay. What are we to make of all this? Well, Hobson was a social democrat. And his whole solution to the problem of imperialism, which he viewed as rooted in this structural problem of capitalism, this problem of underconsumption, overproduction, there's the desperate search for foreign markets and so on, foreign outlets for what could not be absorbed at home. His answer was fairly straightforward. What we need is to raise the living standards of the masses of people. So that workers will earn a whole lot more and they'll be able to absorb the products of industry. Right? Straight social democratic argument. And then Lenin, he basically, when he was dealing with the problem of imperialism, he had to face that argument head on. Lenin says, in theory, maybe, but in reality, you can't do anything like that, because if you did it, capitalist economies would cease to be capitalist. If you raise the living standards of the workers, then you would be having a totally different kind of system. Capitalist societies, capitalist economies as we know them now, are simply incapable of making this kind of transition that Hobson was talking about. I'll read you the paragraph from his pamphlet on imperialism. He says, it goes without saying that if capitalism could develop agriculture, which today is everywhere lagging terribly behind industry, If it could raise the living standards of the masses, who in spite of the amazing technical progress are everywhere still half-starved and poverty-stricken, there could be no question of a surplus of capital. Come back to the capital issue in a second. This argument is very often advanced by the petty bourgeois critics of capitalism. But if capitalism did these things, it would not be capitalism. For both uneven development and a semi-starvation level of existence of the masses are fundamental and inevitable conditions and constitute premises of this mode of production. As long as capitalism remains what it is, surplus capital will be utilized not for the purpose of raising the standard of living of the masses in a given country, for this would mean a decline in profits for the capitalists, but for the purpose of increasing profits by exporting capital abroad to the backward countries. Right? The argument is not that imperialism is lucrative or profitable. The argument is that it's a structural necessity. They have to do it. Otherwise, they'll collapse. I said, well, why this emphasis on the export of capital? Because if you need foreign markets for your surplus production at home, where are those foreign countries going to get the wherewithal to buy what you want to sell them? Not by selling you goods of equivalent value, because that wouldn't do you any good, right? It wouldn't. You want them to absorb your own surplus. You don't want to take just to have a pure exchange with them. So they need the money, and they can only get that money if you invest in those countries, if you export capital, if you lend it to them. So the export of capital becomes crucial for the absorption of your own surplus production. Right? You have to run a trade surplus, and they could only the trade surplus could only be financed if you export an equivalent amount of capital. So the export of capital is also a structural necessity. Right? That's why so much emphasis was placed in that literature on the export of capital. Okay. What are we to make of all of this? Well, you look at that Lenin argument and you compare it with what you know about the history of the industrialized world over the past couple of centuries. And you see, it's just false. These capitalist countries have managed to raise the living standards of the mass of their population quite dramatically. Right? And they have been able to absorb the bulk of their own industrial products without ceasing to be capitalist. No one doubts that, you know, Western Europe, Japan, the United States are capitalist countries. They have been able to do it. When you look at the figures, for example, about British trade and the British export of capital, what do you find? According to this theory, there's a structural necessity for Britain to export a larger and larger surplus. That Britain should be running larger and larger trade surpluses because this whole this excess production has to be exported. Do you know the last year in the 19th century in which Britain ran a trade surplus? 1822. Throughout the rest of the century, Britain ran a trade deficit, was taking in more from the rest of the world than she was exporting. Why? Because she was able to finance that deficit through the profits of her overseas investment. That overseas investment, the export of British capital. According to this theory, as industrialization runs its course, there's a greater and greater need to export capital. To export more and more capital so the rest of the world could absorb your surplus production. But in fact, the export of British capital, which is substantial, was actually declined in the period that we're talking about. It was less on the eve of the First World War than it had been, say, in the mid-19th century. Right? And then, you look at where that capital was going. Was it going to these areas that had been brought under British imperial rule? You know, sub-Saharan Africa, whatever, Sudan, and so on. No, the bulk of it went to the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, yeah. Western Europe. Okay. That's not what you would expect either, is it? So, you know, so people started, you know, they started looking at the figures more closely and said, no, this theory doesn't make sense. It doesn't stand up in the light of the evidence. There's no compulsion. And, you know, you think a little bit about why there was no real structural necessity. This whole notion of wealth being concentrated in fewer and fewer hands. If you look at certain industries, that's the case. You know, in a world of unbridled competition, weak firms get weeded out, stronger firms survive. But during a period of very vigorous economic change, like you had in the 19th century, you are always coming up with new industries. You start with textiles, then you move to steel and manufacturing based on steel, and then you have the electrical industries and the chemical industries and automobile industry coming into the end of this period. You know, as the economy moves, you have these new industries which are dominated by lots of small firms. The whole picture of the economy was something of a caricature, and it failed to understand the powerful dynamics that were at play, tending to raise incomes on the part of the mass of the population in these countries. You can understand why Lenin would want to make the argument that he did, because it's basically saying capitalism is headed for crisis. It's a structural crisis. It's built into the system. Revolution is just a question of time, right? And then he'll say what. Then he'll take the argument and say, and this structural crisis forces these states to pursue these imperial policies, which leads them into conflict with each other, and that conflict is going to bring on a war, and that war is going to hasten the crisis, which is going to usher in the world revolution. You can see why that view was very appealing when Lenin wrote this peace during the period of the First World War, time when, you know, on the eve of the Bolshevik Revolution doesn't stand up. And so people started to say, well, these arguments about the need to export your economic surplus, the need to export capital so that the rest of the world could absorb your economic surplus. These arguments are not true. Then they're kind of political polemics rather than serious economic analysis. But that wasn't the end of it, because then people would say, maybe those general structural arguments weren't valid, but people were concerned about securing the sources of raw materials, food, the primary products that lay at the basis of the economy. Okay. And here again, you have to wonder. This was not driven by the need to control sources of energy, after World War II, when the oil resources in the Middle East came online. You can make an argument that the need to control oil played a key role in shaping the policies of countries like the United States. But these are coal-based economies. Oil does not play a major role as a fuel in this period. And the coal is located within Europe itself. In in the Ruhr Basin in Germany, in in Britain and so on. And the other raw, other central raw material that these countries relied upon for the heart of their economy, namely iron ore for the production of steel, that was also to be found within Europe. What do they need from the Third World? Well, an argument could be made that they needed food. And this is a period when you have a dramatic shift in the geographical distribution of the food production for Europe, away from Europe itself, toward other areas. And what are those other areas? Southern Russia, the Ukraine, basically, United States, Canada, Argentina, great grain-producing, grain-exporting areas of the world. These were not the parts of the world that were targeted for imperial expansion. All right, so what does this mean? So what then was behind it? So, cultural taboo. The whole argument about food, people make that argument. It's not totally preposterous by any means. Because even though with the liberal economy that was developing, liberal world economy of the pre-World War I period, you don't have any trouble feeding your own population. You're able to export to import food relatively cheaply from overseas, from far away. But people were beginning to wonder, how long was that going to last? Can you count on that? For a century from now, decades from now? And what was the argument here? And again, this argument goes back to classical economic theorists of the early 19th century, especially to Malthus, Thomas Malthus. So, population continues to grow. This period of the 19th century is a period of dramatic increase in population on the part of all the European countries except for France. Even in France, it grew somewhat. Very rapid growth in Britain, Germany, Russia, and the United States as well, for that matter. And people project, they extrapolate. Who's going to feed our children? Who's going to feed our grandchildren? These other countries, that control the land, they're going to take care of their own people first. We'll be totally dependent on them. If we don't get, control over the land that we need to produce food will be in very bad shape. It'll be the end of our pretensions to independence, to some control over our own destiny. And these ideas were connected with the Darwinist philosophy, which had an enormous resonance in Europe in the late 19th century. Darwin himself having built on Malthus, a lot of his stuff. The life of nations was a struggle for existence. When your existence was at stake, there were, moral scruples would have to take a back seat. You needed to provide the wherewithal for feeding your own people. That means you needed to control the land that could produce the food to feed an expanding population. You had a temporary surplus of power now. You better use that surplus in order to, create an empire so that you could stand up and become the peer of these great world powers like the British Empire, the Russian Empire, the United States, maybe even China, some people sometimes said in those days. Right? These Darwinist views were particularly strong in Germany. Oddly enough, not in the rest of the Western world, not in Britain, in the United States, or in France. the people who study these things, in fact, refer to the Darwinian non-revolution, because the full implications of the Darwinian philosophy were played down in countries like Britain and the United States. Not so in Germany. Not so in Germany. And it was the most educated part of the population, the part of the population that thought of itself as willing to face reality in a very blunt way, putting all these religious scruples to the side and simply accepting reality for what it was, is revealed by, you know, the sort of thinking associated with Darwinism. This was scientific. These are the principles upon which we have to base our policy. So, and you go back and you read what was being written at that time by the leading thinkers of Imperial Germany. You're just struck by the degree to which they embraced that way of looking. The most important intellectual in Imperial Germany was Max Weber. You've probably heard of him, one of the most famous social scientists of all time. And Weber, like in 1895, was making these kinds of arguments. He says, in 1895, we cannot carry on a policy of national comfort, but must seek one of national greatness, and therefore take this risk imperial expansion upon our shoulders, provided that we want a national existence different from that of Switzerland. And he puts his finger on the demographic problem as the driving force behind an imperial policy. It's not the alleged export policy, but the population increase that will make the struggle for existence a very Darwinian concept. The war of men against men grow harder and more burdensome in the future. We are preaching the gospel of struggle as a national duty, as an economically unavoidable task for the whole, as for the individual. And we're not ashamed of this struggle, the only road to greatness. Okay? It has this kind of racial overtone. We have to pass on to our successors not peace and happiness, but the perpetual struggle for the survival and the improved breeding of our national type. Right? Now, those were the central issues. How many mouths to feed? How much food? You know, how much land to produce it? Those are the central issues that led people to think, especially in Germany, but to a certain extent elsewhere as well, that the creation of a great empire was essential, not for today, but for the distant future. You couldn't rely on the liberal world economy remaining intact forever. What's the great irony here from an historical perspective? This whole notion, it assumed the populations were just going to go on increasing indefinitely at the same rate. It turned out, no, it wasn't to happen. When you look at the figures for population growth for the European countries in general, Germany in particular, decade after decade, through war, through peace, through prosperity, through depression, doesn't matter. The story is the same. Birth rate declines and the death rate declines, but the declines are such that population growth basically levels off to the point where today these populations aren't even replacing themselves. So it was an error, a demographic error that was made. The second error was a miscalculation about agriculture. The assumption was, if you want to increase the production of food, you needed more land. But it's not true. You need more fertilizer is what you need. And in all these countries, instead of having a problem of being able to feed themselves, they have these problems of agricultural surpluses because you just keep throwing in all that fertilizer and, And it's just and developing new kinds of crops, and it's just amazing how much you can produce. So that was the second big area. You put those two things together, and you see that this whole phenomenon of imperialism, which culminated in the Nazi phenomenon of the 1930s and 1940s, was based on a fundamental misapprehension. It's like the horrors of 20th century history, beginning with the First World War, were based on an intellectual error. Very large measure. Okay? So that's all I have to say about imperialism. Next time we're going to go back to the diplomatic story and look at the Franco-Russian alliance and the change in the structure of European politics in the early 1890s.